This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Is the Bush White House getting back on track? Hello again, I'm Orman Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, the daily look at the issues Americans care about most. President Bush has changed the subject in Washington, at least for the moment, by nominating Judge Samuel Alito to the U.S. Supreme Court. Alito has a 15-year appellate court record that's hailed by the right and denounced by the left as extreme. Meantime, Lewis Scooter Libby will make his first appearance Thursday in a court proceeding that ultimately might feature testimony from Vice President Cheney. On To the Point, will a fight with Democrats in the Senate distract from the war in Iraq, Katrina relief, and the continuing investigation? What is the relationship between the Washington Press Corps and confidential sources? On Reporter's Notebook, who is Patrick Fitzgerald? First the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with To the Point. Vice President Cheney's former chief of staff will make his first court appearance on Thursday. On To the Point, how does the current White House scandal compare with those of the recent past? What's the relationship between Washington reporters and confidential sources at the highest levels? On Reporter's Notebook, we'll hear more about Patrick Fitzgerald, the prosecutor who has taken on the Bush White House. First, this news update. Last Thursday, Harriet Myers withdrew from consideration for the U.S. Supreme Court. Today, President Bush nominated Appellate Court Justice Samuel Alito, who was first appointed to the federal bench by this president's father.
In 1990, President Bush nominated Sam Alito at the age of 39 for the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. Judge Alito's nomination received bipartisan support, and he was again confirmed by unanimous consent by the United States Senate. Judge Alito has served with distinction on that court for 15 years and now has more prior judicial experience than any Supreme Court nominee in more than 70 years.
That final remark, of course, in dramatic contrast to the president's contention that Harriet Myers was a good choice because she had no judicial experience at all. Alito's record is so well known that all sides were very quick with public comments. Jim Coonan is Washington correspondent with the Knight Ridder newspapers, covers the Senate. Jim, good to have you with us.
Warren, thanks for having me.
So they were ready to go with this nominee who was telegraphed well in advance by the Bush White House.
It was practically spontaneous. As you know, the president announcement came shortly after 8 o'clock. The emails, the reaction, the press conferences followed shortly.
And they were all pretty predictable.
Yeah, for the most part. There's a few things that we're all here in Washington looking for little signals, some tea leaf. Democrats reacted promptly and negatively, and what's interesting from our standpoint is that those who supported John Roberts, somebody like Patrick Leahy, Democrat from Vermont, who's the top Democrat on the Judiciary Committee, he voted for John Roberts. He came out very quickly to call this nomination needlessly provocative. Harry Reid, who, as you recall, practically embraced Harriet Myers' nomination, said that Alito would leave the Supreme Court looking less like America and more like an old boys' club. At the same time, conservatives, many of whom had, as you know, criticized Myers, some of the leading groups that had led the campaign against her came out promptly to applaud this nomination.
When Leahy, who voted for Roberts, says this nomination is needlessly provocative, what does he mean politically?
I think he's the Democrats made it clear to Bush early on when there were initial discussions as to who his judicial nominees would be, that there were certain people that they were not interested in or would object to if Bush were to nominate them. Roberts was emphatically not on that list. Not that anybody in the Democratic ranks was saying nominate him. They just didn't include him. They knew a little bit about him, and they thought that at least he would be worthy of consideration. Myers was among those that that somebody like Harry Reid urged the president to nominate. But Alito was among the names that that many Democrats are saying, please don't include him in the list. So they're seeing this as a bit of a finger in the eye.
Jim Koonin, who covers the Senate for the Knight Ridder newspapers. So what are we looking for then in the Judiciary Committee, first of all, and if the nomination gets passed there, is a filibuster likely?
Well, I think first with the Judiciary Committee, the first thing we look at is the timing. What does Senator Arlen Specter, the Republican from Pennsylvania, who is a moderate, who does support abortion rights, how does he schedule this hearing? He's won considerable support from both Democrats and Republicans for the way he handled the Roberts nomination, and he was and he despaired that he didn't get a chance to do the same thing with Myers, and was if not angry, certainly upset that nomination didn't go through. So now we wait to see when he schedules these things. The Senate at this point was thinking of wrapping things up for the year by Thanksgiving. I think it'd be hardly reasonable to expect that the hearings and a vote would occur by that time.
Okay, you mentioned the word abortion, and that seems to be the key to this nomination. Why is it?
Because it's the one thing that tends to divide and has always been, if not right in front of senators who are considering these judicial nominations, it's certainly right below the surface.
And this judge has a record of having a dissent in a case in Pennsylvania where he, contrary to all the other judges on the appellate court, said that a woman ought to get the permission of her husband before she has an abortion. Is that right?
Right. And it's a fairly nuanced position that he took. The three-judge panel upheld a Pennsylvania law except for that one provision, and he was the only dissenter in that case, arguing that the spousal notification provision should have been included because in his mind it didn't put an undue burden on the woman.
Okay, and as I understand it also, because he felt that it ought to be the province of the state legislature. Much more to be known about the new appointee and his record. Jim Koonin, meantime, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you, Warren. I appreciate it.
Again, Washington correspondent for Knight Ridder covers the U.S. Senate. We'll be back in a moment. We're taking a long look, or I should say tomorrow, at Judge Alito. In a moment, we'll look at the Bush White House and whether it's getting back on track on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. Last week we saw the indictment of a very high White House official, the chief of staff, now former chief of staff, to the vice president of the United States. The indictment of a high-level White House aide, nothing new in Washington. Some call it a function of the second-term jinx. John Dean was the White House counsel whose testimony to a Senate committee helped bring down his former boss, President Richard Nixon. One of his latest books is called Worse Than Watergate, The Secret Presidency of George W. Bush. John Dean, as always, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Warren.
Karl Rove did not get indicted. The president is not thought of as a suspect in this matter. Is this still worse than Watergate?
Well, the bottom line in my worse than Watergate is that nobody during so-called Watergate abuses of power died. We have people dying today as a result of abuse of power, but I lay that out in a whole book. But the point on
You're talking, in other words, about the war in Iraq, linking that to the leaking of the name of Valerie Plume.
And things like the torture memos and things of that nature.
Okay.
But I did indeed raise this scandal because I've been that has now erupted because I've been following it from day one. We don't know at this point the total damage that was done. Joe Wilson was on last night and obviously said there had been threats against his wife. He wouldn't be more specific.
Joe Wilson, the former ambassador, whose wife is Valerie Plame / Wilson, obviously very involved in this. Go ahead.
Right. And the CIA apparently has not and waited until after the special counsel completed his investigation to do their own assessment of damages to see what has been done. There have been reports to the contrary, but that's apparently the best word of those former employees at the CIA who've been talking to their colleagues, that an assessment hasn't been made. So we don't really know the damage yet that has been done as a result of this leak.
What about damage to the Bush White House and its effectiveness? And does the appointment today of a very well-known conservative judge to nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court suggest that the Bush administration is getting its act together?
Well, it certainly helps deflect the news, and not for your program today, totally, but it does somewhat take attention away from this issue. Now that the indictment has been handed down, it will sort of disappear into the process until the arraignment, and then it'll disappear again until the trial, unless Libby decides to take a plea of some sort, then that would obviously bring it back into the fore. So I think it will. This story will move. He does have a chance now to get on, and you know what we don't know, Warren, is if this is Act One or if it's Act Three of this story.
Again, John Dean, former counsel to President Nixon, recently author of Worse Than Watergate, The Secret Presidency of George W. Bush. Lou Cannon is a veteran journalist, former White House correspondent during the Reagan years for The Washington Post. His books include President Reagan, The Role of a Lifetime, and Governor Reagan, His Rise to Power. Has an op-ed in today's Washington Post also on the current situation and comparing it to past scandals, including those of the Reagan administration. Lou Cannon, always good to have you on our program.
Good to be with you, Warren.
Let me ask you the same question that I asked of John Dean. Is this worse than Watergate? Is it worse than Iran-Contra, which is what Ronald Reagan had to deal with?
Well, with all due respect to Mr. Dean, who in his book is trying to make a larger point, I don't think that any scandal is worse than Watergate. You hear that? I mean, people ever since Watergate have applied the suffix "gate" to everything that came along, but I don't think there are any more Watergates than there's. You know, there was only one Willie Mays, I like to say. Well, there's only one Watergate. But I don't think it's Iran-Contra either. I think all of these things have lives of their own. However, there is a commonality to White House scandals, and the commonality is the cover-up. And it was the cover-up that brought Mr. Nixon down. It was the cover-up both of Iran-Contra and of the Monica Lewinsky scandal that got Mr. Reagan and Mr. Clinton into trouble. The point of my column was that when you're at the center of a scandal, you have an opportunity to do something about it.
If you're the president.
If you're the president of the United States. Mr. Nixon did and didn't and was forced to resign. Ronald Reagan did. Maybe his apology wasn't as fulsome as some people would have liked, but the American people accepted it after he gave his speech saying that he had not told the truth about approving the selling of arms to Iran. I think his poll numbers went up 10%, you know, in a week. Mr. Clinton, after he faced up to the Lewinsky scandal, his poll numbers went up. But nobody has accused President Bush of being at the center of this, and I'm not sure that he's in the position, from what I know, that he could make a clean breast of anything. So I think this thing is going to go on. I mean, I do not think I agree with the point that Mr. Dean made that we don't know whether this is Act One or Act Three, but I think it's. Whatever act it is, it's clearly not the final act. People are going to want to know about Mr. Cheney's role. I mean, did Mr. Libby just think of this stuff up on his own, or did he have a conversation with the vice president? I think this is going to arise. It may not arise tomorrow or a week from Tuesday, but it will come back when there's a trial or when there's a plea. And I don't think this is a scandal that is necessarily going to go away.
I just have to stop for a moment and read the quote that you have in your column today about what Ronald Reagan actually said when he apologized. He said, "A few months ago, I told the American people I did not trade arms for hostages. My heart and all my best intentions tell me that's true. But the facts and evidence tell me it's not." That's just a wonderfully indirect apology, isn't it? Wonderfully phrased.
Well, it was wonderful.
Only Reagan could have said that.
Well, it was, I think, the words written by a very, very fine White House speechwriter, Landon, Parvin. I don't want to belabor this in your program, but there were other people in the which I write about in my book. Casper Weinberger wanted Mr. Reagan to go into in the speech about how Weinberg advised him not to do it and all this other stuff. And Reagan, you know, he knew what he had to do, and he did this indirectly, but it was an admission. People accepted it. I think, Warren, if I can say one thing, I think there's a difference. There's a difference here in another way, which John Dean touched upon. This war is very unpopular. Basically, if you look at Ronald Reagan's policies and Bill Clinton's policies, they weren't that unpopular with the American people, and neither were the presidents. I think this there's a lot of things that Mr. Bush has done that are unpopular, Social Security, private accounts, for instance. So the context of this is that this comes along not in the scandal of not in the context of a presidency where people really like the president and want him to do well, are willing to accept an apology, even if it's an indirect apology. This comes along in the context of a presidency where the president is in deep trouble, where his poll numbers are in decline, where his own party is uneasy about him. So I think it's much harder in this kind of a context to get a recovery than it was for either Mr. Reagan or Mr. Clinton.
Lou Cannon, a former White House correspondent for the Washington Post during the Reagan years, prolific writer about Ronald Reagan, his presidency, and his governorship as well. Back to John Dean, formerly, of course, with the Nixon White House. Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, said today that Vice President Cheney owes the country an explanation of what's going on. He wants Chief of Staff Karl Rove to be fired, even though, of course, Rove has not been indicted, although the special prosecutor says that the investigation will continue. Do you think that it would be good damage control strategy for the vice president to come out and start making statements about what's been going on?
Well, I don't think he's fully assessed the damage yet. No, not unlike the president, this vice president really lives in a bubble, often a bunker. And whether or not he has a feel, and I don't know if any of us know how damaged he is at this point by this revelation. We do know it has raised countless questions. When you read the indictment and Cheney's staff floats through that indictment, Cheney himself does, the big mystery to me is why there is no evidence in all this conversation and all these dealings of a conspiracy. This was the charge that got everybody in Watergate that nailed them. It's Title 18, Section 371, which makes it if you conspire to do something in your job other than doing what your job calls for, you're defrauding the United States of your services, and you can be indicted criminally for that activity. Now, I don't know if putting out and fighting Joe Wilson is what the vice president's staff and the vice president are supposed to be doing. We don't have enough information to really understand it at this point, but there's so many unanswered questions by the indictment.
John Dean, Eric Desenal is a consultant on corporate and political crisis management with Desenal Resources in Washington, served in the communications department of the Reagan White House. Eric Desenal, welcome back to our program.
Thanks for having me.
What about Senator Reid's contention here that it is time for the administration, the vice president for sure, and perhaps even the president, to come forward now, do what Ronald Reagan did, let the chips fall where they may, even if it involves firing Karl Rove?
Well, you know, I think that, first of all, I think that that's a pretty silly idea. You know, one of the things you're always hearing, it's become very fashionable whenever there's a crisis for your arch enemy to get up there and say, you know, if only he would fess up and apologize, then all of this would go away. In 20-some-odd years of doing damage control, I see absolutely no correlation between fessing up and apologizing and forgiveness. The whole idea, you know, this started after Watergate, where people would say, if Nixon had just come out and said, I messed up, the whole thing would have gone away.
But it worked for Ronald Reagan, as Lou Cannon just told us.
Well, I think it did. I think it did eventually. But the difference is by the time Reagan apologized, he knew what was inside the black box. Right now, you don't really. And I think one of the assumptions that is often made in crisis situations is that the people who are principals to the crisis really understand what's going on A to Z. Well, the fact is spending a career in these situations, it takes a while to really understand. And even though Reagan did eventually apologize, he had a few things going for him that Nixon didn't have going for him.
What about the indictment that came out last week, 22 pages long, and talks about Official A, who appears to be Karl Rove, always unnamed in the indictment, talks about the role of the vice president himself as being one of the people who told Libby, contrary to what Libby said, that it was reporters, one of the people who told Libby about Valerie Plame.
Well, just because there is an indictment, there's another part of the mix that has to be remembered, which is that not everybody sees it as the same degree of crisis. I mean, it's the old question about the tree falling in the woods. It's one thing to be morally outraged. It's another thing to assume that this is, no questions asked, a crisis that is going to bring down this presidency. Right now, it could really go either way. This hurricane could blow either way. You could have something that, if it collides with a pop culture phenomenon like Watergate did, you could have people, as Lou said, saying, I don't like this war and I don't like what Libby did, therefore this equals let's bring an end to this administration. The other possibility is that tomorrow morning we capture Osama bin Laden or something else happens which takes this from being A1 in the news to A6. Right now, I am not, wouldn't be so fast at saying that this is the crisis to end all crises.
So keep your head down then at the moment and see what happens.
Well, regrettably, the strategy of Sitzfleisch, a German term, basically means sitting still, is one that works for a while. It doesn't work forever, but it works better than people give it credit for.
Eric Desenall with Desenall Resources, political crisis manager. Back to Lou Cannon, the former White House correspondent for The Washington Post, again during the Reagan years, West Coast correspondent since that time. What does this say, this whole story about the management of news by the Bush White House, and particularly the contention made by Chris Matthews of MSNBC and others, that what they did was essentially feed information on weapons of mass destruction to the New York Times, Judith Miller, have it reported there, and then turn around and say, well, the New York Times says there's weapons of mass destruction. That must be the case. Is that what was going on? And were reporters being used in that way and also to try to damage Joseph Wilson, who was a critic of the war?
Warren, just a slight correction. I don't work for the Washington Post now. I'm a freelancer,
okay,
and I don't want to be flying under false pretenses. The real answer to your question is I don't know, but I don't know what they were saying to Judith Miller or anybody else. But I think it's useful to look at this in some context. I certainly don't think this is a crisis to end all crises, but I don't really anticipate that it's going to bring Bush down. But I think it's something that's very serious, going along with a lot of other things that are serious, and in the context of this unpopular war.
I'm going to ask you to hold off for just a moment because we need to go to a break. We're going to do that. When we come back, we'll pursue this issue of the relationship between the Bush White House and the Washington Press Corps with a very experienced Washington reporter and others. We'll be joined in a moment by Adam Clymer, a former chief Washington correspondent for The New York Times. A little later on our reporter's notebook, we'll be talking about the special prosecutor himself, Patrick Fitzgerald. Who is he? And what can be said about him at this point? A man who's going to be a public figure, whether he likes it or not, for a long time to come. We'll be right back with To the Point on PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. Once again, just a few days after the withdrawal of Harriet Myers and the indictment of Lewis Scooter Libby, President Bush today appointed a very conservative justice, Appellate Court Justice Samuel Alito, to be his nominee to the U.S. Supreme Court. We're talking today about that as an element of damage control, about how serious the crisis is being faced by the Bush White House, and we're talking now about the relationship between the Washington Press Corps and the White House. And right now we're talking with Lou Cannon, formerly the White House correspondent for the Washington Post, no longer associated with the Post, as he indicated a moment ago. And I asked him the question, what about the relationship in this context? Did the White House, he says he doesn't know what the White House said to Judith Miller or whether there was a manipulation with regard to weapons of mass destruction. But the question then becomes, what about the relationship between reporters and officials who are promised anonymity? And is there abuse and manipulation going on? I guess that's the best way, Lou, to summarize the question. And what do you say?
Sorry for the long windup and not getting directly to the question. The point I wanted to make is that, and I covered the Nixon White House during the fall of Nixon and the Ford White House, as well as the Reagan White House, is there is always this transaction going on between White House officials and members of the of the press corps. And as Tip O'Neill used to say about politics, it isn't beanball. The White House is always trying to spin things, and they're always asking reporters for information. I mean, it's a two-way street. Now, what's required of the reporter is a certain skepticism, but it isn't unique or unusual if for the White House to be trying to tell people what they think the case is, or frankly smearing somebody or putting out negative information on somebody. When I was covering the Reagan White House, there was a story which people told me about how we changed the rules of engagement in Lebanon. This prompted a huge investigation into the leaks, which caused a lot of people distress. And you have to know, if you're a White House, if you're a reporter, that if people are telling you something like they're alleged to have said about Mr. Wilson, they're not telling you this purposes of cocktail party conversation. They're telling you this because they want to accomplish something. They want to get it into your publication. And so it isn't. It's a thing that goes on in Washington all the time. And the question is there are two questions here. What did the administration do? The other question is, were the reporters, and a lot of this goes particularly to Judith Miller, were they as skeptical as they should have been about what the administration was trying to do?
All right. Lou Cannon, again, formerly with the White House, as a White House correspondent for the Washington Post. Adam Clymer, as I indicated before the break, former chief Washington correspondent and political reporter for the New York Times. He's now political director for the National Annenberg Election Survey of the University of Pennsylvania, recently retired from that position, as we understand it. Adam Clymer, welcome to you.
Thanks. Good to talk to you again, Warren.
Is this just a matter of skepticism, or are there rules that, or at least informal rules, that need to be followed in order for reporters to avoid being used, for example, to accomplish a smear against somebody?
Well, I think probably I think it's worth noting that of the reporters whom Scooter Libby is alleged to have told about Valerie Plame, several didn't use it. There was no earthly reason for Scooter Libby to leak it to me, but I always thought naming people who worked at the CIA who weren't in public positions, like the spokesman or the director, was something you didn't do casually. Obviously, Mr. Novak thought you did do it casually. And I think that when you get I think the problem is that so much of the discourse between reporters in Washington and people who work in the government is assumed, it's always on background. It's never for quotation. When you ask to put it on quotation, except with a spokesman, the White House press secretary, then it's special. And they say Henry Kissinger used to give on-the-record interviews, and then he'd demand that you read the quotes back you were going to use, and then he'd try to change them. you get into some quicksand with that. And I think this is a particularly egregious case because it can be a violation of law to name a covert CIA representative, and say, and the name to reveal them. And the CIA obviously thought that when her name was revealed that the law might have been broken. And I don't know exactly. Nobody's ever put me in a position of possibly committing a crime while telling me something.
Well, what about, you mentioned Robert Novak, in whose column, of course, the name Valerie Plame first appeared, notoriously, not mentioned at all in the indictment, or, as I understand it, by Fitzgerald. I didn't listen to all his news conference, but I don't think he said much about Robert Novak. What about that case? Where was the story really that Joseph Wilson's wife was a CIA operative, or that the White House was trying to smear him?
Well, of course the White House was trying to smear him. As Lou said, they don't, they're not.
Yeah, but that wasn't that wasn't Novak's story.
It was sort of. No, no, he didn't write that. Novak was an accomplice.
Yeah.
In the effort to
Is that common?
Derogate Wilson.
Is that common in Washington?
Yeah, a little more common than it ought to be.
Lou Cannon, do you find that kind of thing when you were in Washington?
Well, I don't know whether Novak was an accomplice, but he's a columnist, and you know the rules for columnists are
different status.
Pretty well, or I was going to say they're fairly non-existent. I think that that Adam here, who's a reporter whose work I much respect and admire, makes the point here that we need to make. We don't go around naming CIA agents. I've read that statute. I don't think it's a very narrowly drawn statute. You have to know that the person was a CIA agent, right, that they didn't want you to name or anything. And I don't think, and I thought Mr. Fitzgerald was extremely careful and good on that point, and I'm glad they didn't charge something that they can't possibly prove. But apart from the proving it, you don't. There are certain things you don't do. You don't tell people about troop movements, although the Chicago Tribune once did, famously. You don't tell people the names of covert agents because you might get them killed. I think that there's a certain common sense here that would apply in the case of Valerie Plame, which and Adam makes a good point. Most reporters observed. In fact, Judith Miller, who's getting beat up by everybody now, she didn't write a story about this. I mean, the question here is that, I mean, there's two questions. Does this sort of thing go on all the time? Yes. And if you're talking about putting out spin and you're putting out and smearing people, but does it go on all the time that you're naming people who work for an agency whose lives may be in danger if you name them? No, that doesn't go
okay.
on all the time.
All right. I want to get back to this question of the case for war in Iraq being made on background, to use the operative term here. But before we do that, let's go back to John Dean, again, formerly with the Nixon White House. How does this look from inside, and what's the view of reporters from within the White House? You know about the Nixon White House, and you've studied other White Houses as well. Are they tools to be used rather than people that are being asked to convey information so that the public will understand better what's going on?
Warren, when I first went over to the White House in July of 1970, presidents were given the benefit of all doubt by reporters. It's amazing how much they could get away with without being pressed, how much they could leak without ever being questioned on it. And that was really the case until Watergate erupted. And in the post-Watergate years, I watched the press and the dance between the White House and the press corps totally change, where presidents were indeed assumed to be doing wrong, where the burden had shifted, where they almost had to prove their innocence when something, and when they tried to leak something, it was questioned. And this really went on right through the Clinton presidency until the beginning of the Bush presidency, when everything changed back to almost the way it was pre-Watergate. And until very recently, I'd say the first 4 years of the Bush presidency, the news media has given this president and vice president the benefit of all doubts and have not been skeptical, have not been critical. And I suspect that may be one of the most serious impacts of what's happened here is the press is changing its stance.
You were the one first on this program to make the connection between the Plame case and the war in Iraq. Do you think that the war in Iraq, the case for the war in Iraq, was, in fact, made on background by reporters or with the willing consent of reporters who weren't checking the facts?
I don't think there's any question that was the case. And, you know, Judith Miller is a perfect example where her paper had to indeed almost, you know, apologize for her reporting because she was feeding stuff directly in. And indeed, the White House was, in turning around, citing the New York Times as a source. It was quite remarkable.
Adam Clymer, is that too strong a case against the New York Times, your former paper?
No, I don't think so. But I think John maybe I disagree a bit with what he says. I don't think Bush was given an exceptional amount of assumption of truth until 9/11. I think there was a lot of copy that explained how the tax cuts he proposed weren't going to do what he said. I think the stem cell thing was warming up to be some place in which his position was seriously questioned. I think they've gotten away with murder since 9/11. But I don't think they had that aura of perfection in the first 9 months of the term.
Back to this question of complicity by reporters. If, in fact, the White House was trying to smear Ambassador Wilson, was Judith Miller, in a sense, complicit in that by the fact that, as Lou Cannon pointed out, she didn't write a story?
I don't know why she didn't write a story. She says she wanted to and asked an editor if she could, and the editor says no, she didn't. And it's a little hard to figure out Judy in this one. I'm not quite sure. I've never quite understood why somebody would contend that getting to spend that nepotism was involved and it was a great boon for Wilson to get to spend 5 days in Niger. What was second prize, 10 days?
Adam Clymer, formerly with the New York Times. Back to Eric Dizinal, our crisis manager. What do you think about the relationship between the highest levels of government and the reporters in Washington? How has it changed? How does it stand now?
I think the basic change is that there was once a time that reporters were considered, even with any biases, to be referees or umpires as opposed to players in the actual fight. And one of the things that has changed in recent years is nobody sees the media as being objective anymore. It's a sense that, and by both left and right, that it's not even a pretense anymore. And not only that, but it's fair game to drag journalists into the story and to be able to say that the reason why they covered this the way they did is because they either have a left of center or right of center bias. So to me, what the change has been in the last 25 years is not so much that suddenly media people are human beings with biases one way or the other, because that's always been the case. But what makes a difference is I don't think the culture any longer even expects a great deal of objectivity and sort of understands it when journalists become actual players in the brawl rather than just chroniclers of the debate.
Adam Clymer, it would appear that from the indictment that three of the people that will have to testify against the former chief of staff to the vice president are major reporters in Washington, Judith Miller, Cooper at Time magazine, and, of course, the principal Washington reporter and bureau chief for NBC News. What's that going to do to the perception of the role in the media, of the media?
I think what Eric said is a good description of the way people think now. I don't think it's a good description of the reality. And I presume that if these people are used effectively as prosecution witnesses against Libby, it will be another occasion for Rush Limbaugh and Bill O'Reilly and their ilk to say, look, all the reporters are always against Bush. They're trying to get this guy convicted. And they won't, you know, they'll forget that Judy wrote stories that they liked at the time. I think, you know, it'll be used that way. It is used that way. It seems to me that far too many people have decided it's easy to accept the idea that reporters are pushing a political agenda. Reporters like good stories, and reporters tend to be critical of administrations, although, as John Dean said, not critical enough early enough of this one. But the golly, the Clinton people didn't think the press was a bunch of bleeding-heart Democrats any more than the Bush people thinks they're Republicans.
Okay. Forgive my lapse of memory. Judith Miller, Tim Russert of NBC, and Matt Cooper of Time magazine, all potential witnesses against Scooter Libby. Eric Desenall, do you think that this will lead to more attacks, even than we have seen in the recent past, against reporters and their lack of objectivity? Is that going to become even more common than we've had it before?
I don't know whether there will be a sea change upward. I just think that it's become more commonplace. I can tell you when back in the early 1980s, when Lou Cannon was covering the White House, and I was a very young aide in that White House, the idea of engaging on a jihad of some kind against a reporter, well, that was a fireable offense. Now I see both in political life and corporate life making the reporter and their alleged biases the issue is one of the quicker items to tire up on the agenda. And so I think that thing, that aspect has shifted. I think in terms of whether or not this particular crisis takes off, I think one of the big differences is you can't exclude the role that culture plays. I think with Richard Nixon, everybody felt that Nixon personally did it, whereas Reagan and current President Bush always had the sense of, I mean, as personified by their Saturday Night Live impersonations, that there was a certain distance, that they were not Machiavellian and that they weren't responsible for it. And I think that that benchmark is very important.
Final comment from John Dean, a final comment for this segment of our program, former counsel, of course, to President Nixon. Are reporters, do you think, now going to become political targets in a way they haven't been before?
Well, I certainly hope not. It would be quite unfair, but it wouldn't surprise me, indeed, if it did happen. The fact that the attack machinery now includes not only political opponents, but media opponents has become all too common. So it wouldn't surprise me at all.
Thank you all for being with us. John Dean, formerly with the Nixon White House, Worse Than Watergate, The Secret Presidency of George W. Bush, his latest book. Lou Cannon, a veteran journalist, former White House correspondent for The Washington Post. Adam Clymer, former chief Washington correspondent and political reporter for The New York Times. Eric Desenhall, crisis manager with Desenhall Resources, formerly, as he pointed out, a young person in the Reagan White House. Thanks all of you very much for being with us today. Last week, most Americans got their first look at Patrick Fitzgerald, whose investigation led a grand jury to indict the vice president's chief of staff. Fitzgerald's news conference went on for more than an hour, but people who know him say he hates having the spotlight turned on him. We'll hear more about the man who has taken on the Bush White House in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
We're Manalny back with Purporter's Notebook on To the Point. Patrick Fitzgerald says his investigation is not over, and court proceedings against Lewis Scooter Libby are just getting underway. We'll be hearing a lot more about the man that former Attorney General John Ashcroft called America's toughest prosecutor. Kirsten Scharnberg profiled Fitzgerald earlier this year in the Sunday Magazine section of the Chicago Tribune. Thanks, Kirsten, for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
He is currently U.S. Attorney in Chicago. Previously, he worked in the U.S. Attorney's Office in New York. What is it about his record that led John Ashcroft to call him the toughest prosecutor in America?
Well, I think if you look at Pat's background, one of the things that really stands out is the fact that he has been on the forefront of terrorism prosecutions long before anyone else in America, far before September 11th, before anyone else was paying attention to terrorism prosecutions. He became the head of the terrorism unit in the New York U.S. Attorney's Office back in the early 90s. And again, that was a time where terrorism was just starting to come to the forefront. And as the head of that unit, he either supervised or personally participated in some really watershed cases, including, you know, the first World Trade Center bombing, the trial of Sheikh Rahman, who was the blind Egyptian cleric who planned the failed attempt to blow up a number of New York landmarks. He indicted Osama bin Laden back in 1998 before most people had ever heard bin Laden's name. And so I think that when you saw Fitzgerald in the courtroom on these major cases is when people started to fully appreciate how tough he was, and he very rarely is lost.
For what crime did he indict Osama bin Laden in 1998?
For the East Africa bombings, embassy bombings, that happened in August of 98. And he actually tried, prosecuted, and convicted four of the men who carried out those bombings, but he also indicted bin Laden for murder for being, in the words of the indictment, the the leader of that plot.
What's he like?
He's, it's interesting. He's exceptionally, exceptionally personal. And so he's just a private person, and he doesn't like to discuss his personal life. But his friends talk about how funny he is, and the time that I have spent with him, I've seen, he is a funny, engaging person. He's very down to earth, which I think is one of the things that makes him so appealing to juries. He's the son of a New York doorman. As a college student, he would come home to New York during the summers and work as a doorman himself. He's personable. He's funny. His colleagues always talked about how they chose him to lead the road of colleagues who are leaving the U.S. Attorney's Office, because he has a real knack at being, funny and pointed, but also not being nasty the way Rose can sometimes, turn a little bit uncomfortable for everyone in the room. And so he's very likable in many regards, but he's also extremely, extremely tough. His memory is photographic to the point where it's alarming. He'll talk to you about some event from high school, and he'll say, the teacher in this case was Mr. So-and-so, and he lived on such and such street. And I believe the day this occurred was December 16th, 1961. And you're just like, your mind is just spinning at the memory that this guy has, and he uses that in cases.
Of course, you can't really check those memories out, but you have to assume that he's right about it.
Right. And, colleagues talk about this knack at memory. One, a police officer that I spoke with who had done a couple investigations with Fitzgerald talked about at one point Fitzgerald was looking through a phone list, and, it was a list that had hundreds of phone numbers on it, and one number popped out at him, and he said, I've seen this number before. I can't place where. And he just sat there and looked at the number and thought about the number, and the cop in this case is like, what is going on with this guy? And after a while, Fitzgerald said, I think this is the same phone number as X, and he started going through the files on his perpetually messy desk, and indeed it turned out that phone number matched up. And so his memory does tend to be pretty legendary around New York.
Okay. Kirsten Scharnberg, again, the national correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. Now, one of the things that was interesting about his press conference the other day was that even though he hasn't had a lot of them that we know of, he was calling a lot of the reporters by name. Do you think that's because he has such a great memory, or has he had relationships with these reporters that haven't yet surfaced?
I kind of doubt that he's had much of a relationship. I mean, he's pretty by the book, and if he has said that he wants no leaks to come out of his cases, I don't think that they would be coming out from him. One story that comes to mind, one of his best friends, who was actually his college roommate, is an attorney here in New York, and I spent time speaking with him, to do my profile of Pat Fitzgerald. And this friend had seen Fitzgerald shortly after Pat had interviewed the president in the Oval Office. And, of course, the White House had confirmed this. This was no secret at this point. And so this friend said to Pat, wow, that must have been really amazing to be in the Oval Office. And Pat said, I saw those news reports as well, but I can't confirm or deny them. Even though it was in the public domain at that point, technically it was illegal for him to discuss it. And so he was not going to discuss it, even though the White House press secretary had already confirmed that in the public domain. So I have a hard time seeing that he's had personal relationships with reporters on this case.
And you didn't say it, so I'll say it for you. It's my understanding that since you interviewed him last February, nobody's really been able to talk to him at any great length, no reporter.
No, he's kept a pretty low profile. And even when he was speaking with me, this case was certainly off limits. And he was very concerned about, any appearance of him having, any kind of extended conversation with a reporter, and the appearance of impropriety on that, to the degree that we met at a restaurant here in New York. And when he sat down at the table, we were meeting for breakfast, the first thing he said is, I want you to know up front, we're splitting this bill 50-50. And we ordered, omelets. I think the bill came to $13 and some odd cents. And he picked up his 50%, and in fact, he picked up, like I said, it was odd sense, he picked up the extra one penny. And so he was very concerned about the appearance of that.
And he probably remembers exactly what the bill was.
I'm sure he does. You know, I attempted to make a joke. The day that he showed up was actually a day there was a story about, you know, Judy Miller, the New York Times correspondent, and it was on the front page of the New York Times, and I had the paper, and Fitzgerald had canceled on me a number of times because he was so busy, just something would come up and he'd cancel. So finally he arrived at this prearranged breakfast, and he walked in, and I tried to make a joke getting on the CIA topic, and I said, you know, geez, you know, Pat, I can't believe you've canceled on me so many times. I said, according to the New York Times, I said, it appears that I'm the only, you know, reporter in America who actually wants to spend time with you, and you keep canceling on me. And, he kind of laughed, but we were off that topic immediately. He would just not go there.
30 seconds left. Does he have much of a public profile in Chicago? Is he the kind of person who might go from his job as U.S. attorney to candidate for one office or another?
You know, there was speculation on that when a Senate candidate got out of the Illinois race last year, and he, you know, really went out of his way to make it clear that that was a rumor that had no reality for him, that he wasn't interested in pursuing politics. And every time that we've spoken, I've asked him about that, and he's said that he is not interested in that.
Okay.
And he says that, you know, the worst day of his life will be when he's done being a prosecutor.
Well, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. It's
Kirsten,
my pleasure.
Kirsten Scharnberg, national correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. The man we're talking about, of course, Patrick Fitzgerald, the special prosecutor in the case involving Valerie Plame. Today's program produced by Francis Anderton with Cameron Radziner and Katie Cooper, technical director Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.